Good evening, everyone. I'm Nick Brown. I'm one of the three co-chairs of the Young Lions program here at the library, along with Kristen Fisher and Michael Jones, and wanted to welcome you all tonight for what I'm sure will be a very special evening. I won't take up too much time, but I wanted to mention a few interesting points about the library. This is a really important time for the institution. Since the launch of the campaign in 2007, the number of annual in-person visitors has grown to 18 million a year, and we have become the nation's top circulating library. And I think the reason why the Young Lions program is so important is because it represents the future of that growth. And you being here tonight certainly shows that. So if you're here as a guest, and not as a member, we've made it really easy this time. If you look on your seat, there is a nice summary of what comes with a membership and the ways in which you can support. So again, if you're not yet a member, I ask you on behalf of the library to do so. Finally, I wanted to introduce Jadrian Steele to everyone here tonight. I've known Jadrian for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years at this point, and I'll make him blush, but I give Jadrian credit for really bringing this group to the next level and making the Young Lions program, at least in my mind, biased though it may be, the premier group for New Yorkers in their 20s and 30s. So we're really lucky to have him back, and I thank him for all that he does to support this great cause. And I thank all of you for coming here this afternoon, evening, night. Enjoy the panel. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick, and thank you all for being here this evening. In many respects, Ashley Judd needs no introduction, but I'll do one anyway. The daughter and sister, respectively, of two legends of country music, she burst onto the entertainment world in 1993 with her starring role in Ruby in Paradise. And from there, of course, she went on to star in numerous feature films, including A Time to Kill, Kiss the Girls, Heat, a personal favorite of mine, Double Jeopardy, and Dee Lovely, to name but a few. She's won an Independent Spirit Award, been nominated for an Emmy, and also nominated for 2 Golden Globes. Despite her stardom, Ashley, in her new memoir, All That Is Bitter and Sweet, describes acting as her job and not her vocation. Her vocation or calling is to be a humanitarian and an advocate for those suffering in neglected parts of the world. Since becoming the global ambassador for Youth AIDS in 2002, and later in 2004, I believe, a board member of Population Services International, Ashley has traveled to some of the most forsaken corners of the world, including Cambodia, Kenya, Rwanda, and the Congo, visiting brothels, refugee camps, and hospitals for those afflicted by HIV/AIDS. She's testified before the General Assembly of the United Nations, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the National... the National Press Club, and served as an expert for the Clinton Global Initiative and the International AIDS Conference. No slouch in the academic realm either. She graduated from the University of Kentucky with honors. She was a French major with no less than 4 minors. And she recently graduated from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Now, there's a wonderful quote by Robert Egan, which Ashley includes in her book, which for me, having read it, really sort of encapsulates her philosophy. What the eye sees better, the heart feels more deeply. We not only increase the likelihood of our being moved, we also run the risks that being moved entails. Seeing increases our vulnerability of being recruited to the welfare of another. So please join me in welcoming Ashley Judd. So going back to that quote that I just read, Obviously, you felt a strong commitment to helping others throughout your life. But as your book evidences, your work is on a much deeper level than most people would ever even begin to contemplate. And I was just, you know, I wonder, there you were in 2002, sort of at the height of your stardom, you know, what led you to make this decision to take on this journey?
He's just going to go right there from the first question.
We dive right in here.
Well, before I even attempt to answer that, I'd like to say good evening and thank you so much for having me. And it's wonderful to be in this venerable building with yet another endangered species, the card catalog file. I think I might go in there and have a big sniff before I leave. It's obviously a very special American landmark, and it's just now dawning on me that I might be in its card catalog at some point, and that I'm here, the New York Public Library, as an author, huh? And I'm very touched that you chose that particular quote. I'm fond of my own writing, it makes me cry. Professor Keegan was one of my great favorites while I was at Harvard, and there was a class called Poverty and Social Policy, which is really why I thought I was going to Harvard in the first place. I was obviously very interested in poverty alleviation, social justice, human rights, public health, and that class seemed, I would have imagined, to be exactly what I would have expected to learn. And yet Bob Keegan's class on adult development was offered at the same time. And I spoke with my advisor about it, and I also visited some with Professor Keegan, whom I didn't know well yet. And he actually made an appeal to me to have the willingness to trust that adult development has everything to do with poverty alleviation, social justice, and human rights. And that as we seek to improve the grassroots programs and reverse, you know, institutional failures and make progress within our supranational bodies to serve the people better, that we're also wanting to build individual capacity to tap into our innate resilience, and that ultimately it's that self-efficacy that's going to change the world. And so I took adult development and read extraordinary quotes like that. He is a neat guy. Are you all familiar with subject-object theory at all? And my story could actually be told through the lens of subject-object theory, where I was subject to my childhood until I got help. I was subject to it. It held me, and my relationship with it was really dictated by, from a place where I was kind of the, I was sort of the disempowered person, even as adult, relative to. And then as I got into my own recovery and I got my own help and my own self-efficacy and resilience began to grow, I began to hold it as object. You know, and a lot of people have said, why did you choose to tell your story in the book? And it was never my intention. But eventually I got to a place in my life where my story was no longer my story. It's God's story to use, however he or she sees fit. And at the end of my life, all I have is my story. So it's one of those wonderful spiritual paradoxes like they talk about in the Babylonian Talmud. The whole world was made for me. I am nothing but ashes and dust. All I have is my story, and yet it's really not my story. I choose to give it to the universe to perhaps help another being. And that idea that my ability to be useful is exclusively contingent on my willingness to allow myself to be recruited to the welfare of another. And that recruitability is contingent upon my ability and my willingness to see, to validate another person's experience, to witness their life, to be with them in their process. So, I also got an email today from Professor Keegan, who is really precious to me. I had a really bad, very torrid, there's not a lot of time at Harvard for depression, so it had to be quick. I had a quick bout of depression, actually, while I was at Harvard. I just kind of fell through the trap door. Some things sort of got to me, and everybody else, I don't know what they did on their spring break, but I went back to treatment. And he was one of the people that I really trusted and confided in during that. And he became a dear friend, and he is a hero to me because he's so smart and a really exquisite scholar, yet at the same time, he's just all heart. So it's very special to me that you would choose that to start off our evening. And it may seem like I've completely sidestepped your question, but really, I think I answered it. Do you kind of see? And it's that Edith Wharton line, too, where the end is latent in the beginning. You know, I didn't even know this until recently, but I was one of the highest paid women in the history of Hollywood. Mm. And that may not be adjusted for inflation, because Myrna Loy was a really big star, as was Mary Pickford. She was the first woman to actually own a studio. But I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm-hmm. And I got a couple of very auspiciously timed phone calls, as a friend of mine likes to say, is it odd or is it God? One was from my friend Bobby Shriver, who was bothering me about something, as is his wont, and a woman named Kate Roberts, whom I did not know, who was asking me to be the global ambassador for something called Youth AIDS. I didn't know what Youth AIDS was, but I thought, global ambassador, that suits my impression of myself. And I said to Bobby, Bobby, I'm working. That's how we talked to each other. Leave me alone, I'm working. Hung up on him. So he calls me back with Bono. He's raising the stakes. And they were essentially asking me to do the same thing at the same time, which is to allow myself to be recruited to the welfare of others.
Mm-hmm. And so then there you were on your first trip, which was obviously emotionally profound in terms of the experiences you had on that trip and seemingly led to this current vocation. There are so many unbelievable stories, and this gets back to the theme that you were talking about, being a storyteller, obviously both as an actress, now as a writer, but you also seem to value greatly the importance of sharing other people's stories, which you communicate so beautifully in the book, stories that you've heard throughout your travels. I wondered, maybe before we even get here, we should talk more specifically, more generally rather, about when you go on these missions, be it to India or the Congo. I mean, obviously each one is different, but what is an average day for you like when you're there?
I like that question because I like being on those trips. And may I pause briefly to do a bit of housekeeping and self-care? I'm getting really cold. Is there any hot water maybe or something hot that I could hold? That'll warm me up. Thank you. Well, everyone walks on eggshells when they tell me that I have to get up at 8. That's how the days start. My husband says I do many things well, and morning is not one of them. No, I'm teasing. I've gotten better at mornings. But I wake up and I grope on the nightstand to get some sort of spiritual literature, something inspirational that I have with me, because I think that the quality of those thoughts is generally superior to what my unaided mind produces. So I try to directly deposit that sort of stuff into my brain. I get on my knees and I pray. That's something that I've been doing for a while now, and it really works for me. And, you think this is like not necessarily the question he asked, but this is everything. It's everything, because the work is hard, it's shattering, and without some kind of a spiritual practice and confidence in a power greater than myself, I'll burn out and I might even die. And there are more ways to die than just by stopping breathing. And to me, to stop doing this work would be a death. So I pray and I remind myself that I'm powerless over people, places, and things, and that my life gets really unmanageable very fast when I forget that, but that I do believe in some kind of a power greater than myself, and I generally call it the power of my misunderstanding or my limited understanding, but that there is something. And I think that it doesn't live in the carpet and it doesn't live in the sky, it lives in the hearts of all of us, and that we're equally valuable and precious, that no one is disposable, and that when I have the courage and vulnerability to sit with another human being, I am invoking the presence of that power. And I really love Rabbi Hillel's quote, which I'm sure many of you know, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? I have to be able to take a stand. I have to be able to use my voice to advocate my own best interests. Get some hot water when I'm cold. And if I am only for myself, then what am I? Not who am I, but what? And if not now, when? Which is that fierce urgency of now. And it's that one, it's Ubuntu, you know, as the Africans say. It's the complete interconnectedness of all things, of myself and you. And so I remind myself that I'm turning my will and my life, my will is my thoughts, my life is my actions, over to the care of this power. It's an important word to me. It's care. It's not, you know, direction or authority. It's care. And then I just go do the next good, right, honest thing, you know? And I eat really simply when I'm on these trips. I did Rachel Ray earlier today, and I thought they were going to ask me all these culinary questions, and it was reminding me that I don't eat anything. I don't do anything exciting. I mean, I've been to some of the most interesting places in the world, and I've seen nothing but brothels and slums and hospices and presidential palaces, the latter of which are not very interesting. I have to withdraw my senses, because when we go out into the field, it is such a sensory assault that I have a really austere life when I'm on a trip. I eat the same thing every day. I take a jar of peanut butter with me for low blood sugar attacks. And then we just dive in. You know, something happens. Some sort of state of grace overtakes me. And say, you mentioned India, go to Kamathipura. Has anybody ever been to Kamathipura or read about it? It's just an absolutely ghastly rabbit warren of a brothel district. There's about 5,000 brothel-based, brick-and-mortar brothel-based sex slaves. And, you know, I'm very fortunate because PSI is such an exquisite agency, and they have the respect and admiration of local population. And our staff is local, and so everything's, of course, culturally appropriate, very sensitive, very respectful within the absolute local experience. And there's someone who's, I have some language skills, but there's always someone there who speaks the local dialect, and they just introduce me. And then magic happens. People, it's like I walk in and they turn their mouths on and they start to tell me their stories. They talk, I love them. We cry, we grieve, we laugh. I mean, there's a lot of gallows humor in these places. Sometimes I'm still shocked and appalled. I mean, I got kind of arrogant after 7 or 8 countries. I thought, I can't be shocked anymore. And then I met some women in Madagascar who were actually so poor that they pool their resources to raise a dollar so they can buy a piece of plastic, and it's out of that that they fashion their brothel directly on the sidewalk. And when I was there visiting them, it's called the rice tents, there was a man holding his infant son while his wife was having coerced prostituted sex. It's about $2 US. Thank you very much. But a lot of time, with a condom, and then a lot of time, men will offer to pay more money for sex without a condom, and I can actually still be shocked, it turns out. And I hold babies, and I get on my feet and touch, you know, get on my knees and touch the feet of old people, and, you know, we talk about what works and what doesn't work, and you get back in the car, and everybody says to me, did you smell the poop on that one? And I say, no, not really. And then I go back to my hotel, and the writing begins. You know, it's like I'm just rocking until I can start to write. And when it started in Phnom Penh, I'd been in Sve Pak, the notorious brothel district there, and I didn't have any place in my brain to put this, and I didn't have any place in my heart that could hold it, and so I had to start putting it on the page. Mm. And it became a sacred incantation. I was obsessive about capturing every story, every detail, you know, the ages of the children. Oh, but she's also taking care of her brother's children. I had to get it all down.
Catharsis.
And it was like, she matters. You know, she matters. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to write about the programs that I saw, because they're inexpensive and effective, and the people who create and administrate them locally are the unsung heroes of our world. And it became so important to me to honor and celebrate them. And then I just needed to process. You know, I needed to kind of work out my own salvation, if you will. And all of a sudden, I'd written 650 pages. And then it became a book. Mm-hmm. And so we also, you know, we meet with donors, and we have press conferences, and We recruit local stars. We love to use local athletes in particular and help redefine what it means to be a man. I have been tested for HIV a lot. I do that in public a lot. I did it once in South Africa with the entire cast of a popular soap opera, which was very courageous of them given the stigma around HIV. And, you know, I visit with the Prime Minister and the Minister of Health, and then sometimes there's those, especially African countries that had been colonized by the Belgians or the French. I mean, the procedural stuff is so boring. It just is very tedious. So sometimes I have to do that stuff too.
You shared the story about the prostitutes in Madagascar, which was quite horrific as depicted in your book. I wondered if there was another story or if that was the one that affects you the most, a personal story. I mean, for me, when I read it, it was the story of Shola. Is that how you say her name? In Kenya?
Shola in Kenya,
which was quite special, you know, just in terms of my own, you know, experience.
Well, why don't you tell Shola's story? Because that's what it's about.
Oh, well, I think
she gave it to me, and I gave it to you. And now it's your story to tell on her behalf.
The pressure is on here, although I think...
And remember, as my many says, what comes from the head goes over the head. What comes from the heart goes straight to the heart. So what about Shola's story touched your heart?
Shola was a prostitute in Kenya, and she had two children, I believe, and she traveled quite a long distance into, I don't remember the town.
To Nairobi.
In Nairobi, to prostitute herself in the evenings. She was apparently quite beautiful and striking, and one of her children was born ill, I believe, and she needed $250 American dollars for the treatment, or I can't remember what it was, but she was obviously not going to get there doing it the way she was on the street. I think that you said at one point that there is a seemingly global baseline for impoverished countries for sex, and that's about $2 for one act and $3 for another. Ashley and Kate Roberts, who she mentioned, who I think is the president of PSI or
she thinks
founder,
so.
Or,
yeah,
broke with their
convention,
yeah. Which was never to rescue someone. That was not what they did. That there were organizations that were there for rescue. They were there for education, and they cobbled this money together, and then shared with her how to hide the money so that she wasn't mugged on the way home. And then you even made an introduction, I think, to a modeling agent or something. Is that
true? You got it right. And it wasn't a test. And it's interesting what people remember, you know. And Shola is a really classic example of what life can be like for a disempowered African woman, because she didn't have property rights and she didn't have legal rights. And so she was set up in her poverty when her dad died and his brothers came in and took the house and moved her off the land. So she became homeless. And her husband, or her boyfriend, she and her boyfriend had gotten pregnant. And when she got pregnant the second time, he abandoned her and the babies. She had only been to the fourth grade. She had, her mother had died. You know, and it all of those things were implicated, where because she was the girl and the mother died, she was the one who had to walk for the firewood to be able to make the fires and to boil the water and all of that stuff. You know, girls in Bangladesh spend 6 hours a day doing chores, which is why they can't go to school. So when Shola had her, she was still lactating. When I met her, she was still lactating because she was still breastfeeding, trying to breastfeed both of her children because she didn't have enough money to buy them food. And yeah, it was not at all what I would have hoped for her, but it was mentioned that she was so beautiful in like trying to do triage, like cash triage, where can we get it, that maybe she could do some modeling, which was just completely not what I would have wanted for her. But anyway, there are a lot of stories like that. And We are not a rescue organization. We are a public health agency. And because on that institutional level, we are agnostic about slavery, pimps and madams let us into their brothels so that we can help protect and empower the health of those who are being exploited. We do malaria prevention and treatment, obviously HIV prevention, STD prevention. Last year, PSI helped avert 3 million pregnancies amongst poor women in the global south. We're starting to really scale up with long-lasting, reversible contraceptive methods to make it really easy, especially for rural women who have difficulty finishing that last mile or kilometer to get to their healthcare provider so that they can get out of the cycle of having baby after baby after baby. And I'm sure you all know this, for every year a girl stays in school, it delays her marriage, the birth of her first child, her ability to care for herself and her children, her ability to generate income, and it reduces the number of children she has. So family planning was lost for a little while. They actually call it the lost decade. They're starting to call it that in the public health world. And PSI has always had a really strong emphasis on that. And Shola's a really good example. If she'd had any knowledge of how her body worked or any information about how to prevent unintended pregnancy, she probably would not have been enforced prostitution.
Hmm. You touched on this at the very beginning. But Gandhi, who I know, you hold great reverence, said that the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. And what I found particularly interesting about your book was the journey of self-discovery that took place internally while on your several missions internationally. And I hoped that maybe you could just speak about that for a few moments.
Sure. It's such a wonderful quote that the way to find the self is to lose the self in service to others. It cannot be read in segments. It must be taken as a whole. To lose oneself in service to others. Because we have so much loss of self in this country through addiction, dysfunction, codependency. We're human doings instead of human beings. We think that what we do imports our self-worth, or our address in town somehow increases our esteemability, both in our own eyes and through the eyes of our cohort. And it's really easy for folks who already have lost their sense of self to confuse that direction to service and become caretakers instead of caregivers. And a caretaker is taking something. They're taking someone's dignity. You know, I have learned in my recovery not to do for others what they can and should do for themselves. So there's a real distinction between charity and justice, between pity and empathy, between identification and looking down upon. So for example, the conditions in which I was raised and the kind of neglect and abandonment and abuse that I went through, the circumstances are very different. Yet there's an emotional identification with people I've met all over the world. And it's just always something that I think it's important to point out, because there can be that tendency to want to be a do-gooder without having gotten this piece worked out first. And I know, because that's what happened to me. You know, I got started with PSI, all the earnestness in the world, so incredibly willing. And yet I hadn't done my own family of origin work yet. I hadn't figured out that I was so attracted to humanitarian work, and that I could withstand being in situations of such emotional extremes because I had my own unresolved trauma. And of course, all it did was trigger my trauma. I didn't have something, I read this expression recently and I really liked it. I didn't have mastery yet over my own trauma. And I started to find that mastery when my sister, who has an eating disorder, went to treatment for help for her eating disorder, and I was invited to visit her in treatment, something called Family Week. All that's in the book. It was an absolutely extraordinary chapter to write. I loved writing it. And to cut to the chase, at the end of this family week, when they were making recommendations to us as to how to support our recovering compulsive overeater, in her healthier way of life, different suggestions for us. You know, we suggest this 12-step program for you. We suggest you come to a workshop. There are certain professional recovery authors that might benefit you to read. And then they looked at me and said, we'd like to invite you to stay. And I said, well, I'd love to stay and do one of your 6-day workshops I've read about. And, oh, no, Ashley, we'd like to invite you to stay for 42 days. Now, I thought I went to Buffalo Gap, Texas, where this treatment center is located, to have the satisfaction of seeing my mother put in her place. Preferably tarred and feathered and swinging in the town square. I was a little angry at the woman at the time. And in fact, I was put in my place, right where I belonged, an inpatient bed for 42 days. And I give so much credit to that treatment team because I am just adult child of alcoholics. I am just from a family system that didn't work very well. I presented with no chemical dependency. I don't have an eating disorder. I don't even really like to shop. My clothes are free. You know, I'm not out there in the world doing that kind of stuff. But they recognized in me the effects of living in an alcoholic family system. This didn't make a lot of sense to me because the alcoholic of whom I was aware at the time was my Papaw Judd. Never saw the man drink. He ran the fill-in station. He was well-loved in town. He scrambled me eggs for breakfast. How did this alcoholic affect my life, you know, in 2006? But anyway, there was a woman there at this treatment center who's absolutely spectacular. And when they were making the suggestion, my family was you know, hysterical and, oh, you really need help. I mean, is there anything more irritating than to hear your family say you need help? So I just couldn't look at them anymore, so I looked at her. And there was something in her that was wordlessly communicated to me in that moment. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted what she had.
This is Tini.
This is Tenny.
Tenny.
And it turns out that what she has is serenity and peace of mind in spite of and no matter what is going on. And I decided in that moment that I wanted what she had, and I knew I would have to become willing to do what she had done to get it. And so I was going to have to go do this recovery thing. I was going to have to do my own treatment and become a member of the appropriate fellowship for me. And so I did. You know, I surrendered and I went to treatment, and I have a life beyond imagination today as a result.
Do you think you would have gotten to that point without your journey?
Well, interestingly, when I nodded my head to Tenny, which was my surrender, she looked to my family and she said, no one ever thinks to do an intervention on the lost child. And I played the lost child role in the family, but I also was the hero child because that's what they needed me to be, because if I was the hero and I was okay, then they didn't have to pay attention to me. And obviously, my life looked fantastic. You know, I own my home. I don't have debt. My husband's pretty hot, you know? And my shoes are cute. Aren't they cute? And what was I saying? Oh, yeah, when I've gotten there, I distracted myself. I don't know how far down the scale I would have had to go. You know, I didn't have an eating disorder, but bulimia is about anger, and I was pretty angry. I could have become bulimic. I was pretty desperate for a good night's sleep. I could have probably, I've speculated, been one of those who gets, you know, messed up on Ambien and the other kind of stuff that goes around. And I'm just real grateful that I didn't have to. In some ways, I was real high bottom, as they say. You know, I wasn't abusing alcohol. I was drinking the right wine with the cheese. Any of you relate to that? But inside, it was real low bottom. You know, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I was so grateful when someone finally pointed out to me that there was hope and help for families of alcoholics, because it's abusive to point out a problem without also highlighting a solution. And that's absolutely what they gave me at Shades of Hope. They pointed me to the solution. Now, it's been my job on a daily basis to choose to live in the solution. I'm working with a girl right now, 14-year-old, who knows what the solution is, and right now she doesn't want it. And that's why I've got my phone up here, because she's sitting in a city jail somewhere because she's just run away from treatment. So we can carry the message, but we can't carry the person. And I'm just real grateful that I was desperate enough to accept help, because not only has it changed my life, if y'all read this book and something in it touches you, there's the possibility that it can make a difference in the lives of a lot of people.
You mentioned the writing process, and I'm just curious to touch on it for a moment, because I think your co-writer, Marianne Voller, is here somewhere.
Is Marianne here? Hi, Marianne. I couldn't have done this without Marianne. Hi, Marianne.
I was just curious what your process was like working together.
She's the boss. Well, I have a very special literary agent, a woman here in town named Trina Keating, and she suggested that I take a look at Marianne's work, and I decided that, and Marianne had and I had a wonderful conversation on the phone. Marianne wrote Secretary of State Clinton's book with her, and she really scared me. And I thought, that's probably a good thing. And she started patiently reading all 650 pages of those diaries and looked at different things that I had written, forewords to books, chapters in books, read my academic writing, came to the farm in Tennessee, spent a lot of time visiting with me and getting to know me. I suggested that she get to know Tenny, because she is such an integral part of my journey. So Marianne had the willingness to get to know more about that process. And she started plucking out, she started identifying different narratives from the diaries that she really thought we should keep in the book. And then I'd sulk for a week because I wanted everyone to be in the book, because it was really hard. On my own, I wouldn't have been able to make those choices. And, you know, Marianne did wonderful writing, and she helped me with bridges and transitions and placement, and she had her hand in the small of my back pushing me to include my own story. And sometimes it was delightful, and other times it was real hard. And in the end, together, I think we've made a beautiful book.
Mm, I absolutely agree. I'm sure that there are many people out there who might have some questions, so I don't want to monopolize it myself.
And I just turn my mouth on and I go, go, go. So I'm sorry if I've talked too much.
I think we have microphones over here on both sides. Anyone?
It's like the Colony Club. They were shy.
Always need someone to break the ice. Here we go.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your name?
Madeline.
Hi, Madeline.
Thank you very much for coming and joining us this evening, and I look forward to reading your book. But before I do so, I heard you talk a little bit about your treatment and some of the healing that you've gone through. And so my question to you is, would you consider that the poor that you visited also healers? And if so, what would be an example of that? If the poor, the
absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely. Oh,
you.
My gosh. I don't know that there's anything more powerful than a wounded healer. And this is one of the things I love. Women for Women International is an organization I adore. And when I started, I was just working with PSI. And as I mentioned, we're a public health agency. We're not, for example, a sex slavery rescue organization. Through health empowerment, we do help prevent sex slavery, because we help the poor avoid the health issues and financial insults that are related to poor health that can push girls and women into prostitution, either because they have no other choices or because a man in the family pimps them to raise capital. So in that sense, we are a prevention agency, but as soon as I started hanging out in brothels, I realized I had to partner with other agencies. Such as APNEAP International in India and Women for Women International. And what I see in particular when I visit Women for Women International's programs is exactly what you're talking about. Through these really simple programs, civic empowerment, teaching women about their legal rights, obviously vocational training, I watch women travel the spectrum from victimhood to survivorhood. And it's so interesting that the differences are nominal, but they're so consequential. So here's a woman who is a survivor of multiple gang rapes by armed militia in Congo. Horrific experiences, and she is shut down and traumatized and nonverbal and on her own, isolated, because that's what patriarchal wounding does. It really isolates women. And I like this guy with the tie who's nodding his head to that. And then over here, you have 100 women who are survivors of multiple gang rape by armed militia in Congo. And they're ululating, la 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 la, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and they're clapping. And when one's trauma goes up and her eyes go away, someone slaps her on the back and gives her a hug, or puts, you know, more wet clay in her hands for the pottery that they're making. They don't have to be alone anymore. And they're absolutely healers. They absolutely are. And they really are the experts. They are the policy experts. And anything that is created on an NGO or institutional or governmental level should absolutely be informed by survivors' experiences at the household level.
Any other questions?
Huh? I liked your nodding to yes, patriarchal wounding isolates women. What's your name?
It's Robert. And
hi, Robert.
Thank you for speaking so honestly about your experience, especially your family's experience in alcoholism. I think each of us, either personally or through a friend, can relate to those experiences. And just personally, it gives me strength to hear you speak so publicly about these issues. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. Given your time at the Kennedy School of Government and given your experience traveling the world, my interest is in whether or not you see the future in Women for Women or PSI working at a very granular level with individuals in order to affect change for millions of people, or if you think that there's a different model out there that perhaps hasn't been quite uncovered yet, or maybe it hasn't been fully leveraged, but wider, whether it's USAID or the State Department or whomever, that isn't getting things quite right and could learn a lot. Because at the end of the day, you speak so eloquently about some people, but we all know that it's millions of people.
Right.
So how can all of us leave here tonight armed with some information that helps us affect more change on a wider scale? And maybe that question is, maybe it's a question that you don't have the answer to, but I'm just curious, given your experience in this graduate program, if you've picked up anything along the way, tips or tidbits that you can share with us?
It's a great question and really good observations. And, you know, I think there's probably a course at the Kennedy School about what you just said. What I do when I get a question like that is I just try to bring it back to myself, because that's really the only expertise that I have is my own experience. And I went to the Kennedy School thinking I might run for office someday. And in particular, I'm already a write-in candidate on ballots in Kentucky for everything from basketball coach to governor. And I'm not real tickled about the direction that things are going in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and particularly the mineral exploitation in the East. And I get a lot of encouragement to run for office, a lot. So I went up there thinking that I would be open-minded enough to take a look at it. And I was surprised that my experience at the school was so nurturing. Were you at the college? Where did you go?
Princeton.
Sorry.
A little south of there.
Is nurturing a word that you associate with Harvard?
No.
Yeah, it was.
Nerds,
amazing.
Maybe, but.
just
kidding.
So wait a minute. My team beat your team in the opening round of the NCAA tournament.
No, Princeton got in, didn't they?
No.
Kentucky.
Typical Ivy League. Doesn't even know. My freshman point guard, Brandon Knight, scored a bucket at the buzzer to beat, no, it was a really good game. Anyway, what happened for me during my course of study was a robust revalidation of the infinite worth of the individual, that no one is disposable. And I thought I was going to come out and perhaps start to work with people in large numbers and perhaps represent, you know, thousands in a district. And in fact, I was recommitted to speaking about the individual and making those connections and getting the sacred narrative of a Kika or a Shola or an Ukshre Layok and sharing it. And where ultimately I go with that, I don't know. I mean, my life works pretty well right now. I love the organizations with whom I'm affiliated. I'm also now on the board of International Center for Research on Women. And I think my, you know, my gut level answer to the question is, I believe that we're all most impactful when we're coming from our souls, when we are, to use your word, leveraging our core values. And my godmother, who is from Eastern Kentucky and is very fancy and lives in San Francisco and has for many years, has a pet pig. And she's the only person I know of in Pacific Heights who has a pet pig. And she can be a little defensive about it. And sometimes people come over and they're like, what? And she goes, it's my pig. And that's her way of saying it's her thing. And that's become a saying with me. Everyone has to find their pig. Find your thing. Where is your outrage? I'm a survivor of sexual childhood abuse. I have righteous anger about sexual abuse. It's my pig. I can work on this issue for the rest of my life. What is your pig? And then leverage from there. And I believe that that's where you'll make the biggest difference.
You start your book with Edith Wharton, and we'll end this conversation with Edith Wharton. She has a quote that
she'd be most pleased.
There are two ways to spread the light.
Yes, it's a great quote.
To be the candle or to be the mirror that reflects it. What are you?
I'm the mirror that reflects it. I am just the mirror that reflects it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
So glad to be here. Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was lovely. I needed that. I had a hard afternoon.
Oh, really?
Well, this girl I'm dealing with. It's just so pleasant. I don't want to go.
We have books for sale, and I think you might sign a few.
Sure, be glad to. Provided that I wasn't able to book that 8:15 massage. Oh, I just cracked myself up.